Welcome to the Raging Rhino Podcast. This is podcast number 88. My name is John. Better get ready to see the light. Love. Love is the answer. And that's all right. The Wonder Woman movie officially debuted June 2nd. Even though it's been out for about a month, I want to warn anyone listening. This episode will contain major spoilers about the movie. I've mentioned many times before that I love DC Comics. It's not too often that I turn this podcast away from politics or libertarian philosophy, but when I do, it's most likely because I want to talk about a movie from the DC Extended Universe, or DCEU. If you want to go back to about a year ago, I spoke at length about Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice. And I opened with the story of my first comic book that I ever bought, Flash number 275. Growing up, I gravitated toward the B and C list characters. Green Lantern and Flash were easily my favorites, along with the likes of Martian Manhunter, Firestorm, and sometimes even D-listers like Blue Devil or the Will Payton Starman. DC's Trinity, though, Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, was never that important to me. They were the popular ones. They had their movies and or television shows, and if there were a cartoon, from Super Friends to Justice League Action, those three would probably be in it. You could expect to have at least one of them in any given issue of Justice League of America. Even the comedic take by Keith Giffen and Company in the 90s heavily featured Batman. That Flash comic, that was the first I ever bought? A couple of issues later, a despondent Flash seeks out help from other superheroes. Which ones? Well, Green Lantern, who was his best friend at the time, Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman. If a solo superhero comic needed a boost in sales, suddenly there would be a reason for Superman, Batman, or Wonder Woman to guest star. So I would have a good chance of seeing them pop up in some other lesser-known superhero series I bought. Growing up, the debate was always, who do you prefer, Superman or Batman? It was always those two. But something happened in the mid-80s. DC did something that, at the time, was new and unusual. They rebooted their universe. In Crisis on Infinite Earths, DC basically wiped the slate clean, and in the process, Wonder Woman was rebooted under the guidance of my all-time favorite comic book artist, George Perez. Back then, I had been in comic books for less than a decade, but I knew about Perez. I had been following his work in Justice League and the New Teen Titans before he did the artwork in Crisis on Infinite Earths, which held the challenge of showing almost every single DC character in their history. So it was natural for me to jump to his latest project, even though it was a character I never really focused on. He wrote and drew the comic, and he was at the height of his artistic ability. Every page of his Wonder Woman issues was filled with elaborate detail and beauty. Now, here's the thing with comic book characters. Actually, any fictional character. Any character can be great. It just depends upon the writer. I mean, just look at what Gail Simone did with Catman. Yes, I said Catman. Or Geoff Johns with Hal Jordan that brought about his resurgence. Or Grant Morrison's use of Plastic Man during his Justice League run. Perez took Wonder Woman to new heights. He sacrificed one thing along the way that I think did more for the character than anything else. He got rid of the invisible jet. And instead, she glided on air currents, which quickly became flight. The style of the central villain in the movie, Ares, comes from Perez's run. Oh, and by the way, this was back when the last couple of pages of comic books were set aside so the company could publish and respond to fan letters. I got two of mine published. And there was still, unfortunately, a deep prudishness in comics at that time. So it was never shown in the comic itself, but Perez was the first to acknowledge in the Wonder Woman Mail section, Postscripts to Paradise, that it stands to reason for the women of Themyscira to have same-sex relations with each other. I mean, it just makes sense. It's an island of only women. In recent years, this has become more prevalent and part of Wonder Woman's story, and the recent DC Bombshells continuity depicts Wonder Woman as openly bisexual. So, in my late teens, I finally got a good taste of Wonder Woman before I went away from comics in my early adulthood. Now, since I came back, Gail Simone and Brian Azzarello have had notable runs that I loved, and I would recommend both to anybody remotely interested in the character. DC has their big three, their trinity, Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman. Batman is a superhero because of fear, and he operates within fear. He's afraid that someone may face the same horror at the hands of a criminal as he did. That's why he uses fear and intimidation to fight back against the bad guys. Superman is a superhero because of hope. He's always been that example of the best a person can be, even while dealing with his own self-doubt. That's why all the other heroes in the DC Universe look up to him as their example. No matter how fierce the battle, if Superman is there, then there's hope. But Wonder Woman is a superhero because of love. She loves humanity, even her enemies. Maybe that's how her character has evolved over the past 75 years, and maybe it's that way because it seems to be a more innate quality in a female character. But it sets her apart as a stronger base motivation than the other two. Batman may be the smartest, Superman the strongest, but Wonder Woman is the most noble. I love my B and C list characters, but when it comes to DC's Trinity, Wonder Woman is far and away my favorite. I wanted a lot out of the Wonder Woman movie, and I was thrilled with the result. Now, there's plenty of things that I liked about it, and I'm going to get to those in a few minutes. But I like to get the negative things out of the way when I talk about my DC movies. So I'm going to start with the negative. Basically, DC caved in and made their movie in the style of Marvel's superhero movies. That's not a bad thing in and of itself, but that tactic homogenized the movie for me. It became like all the others in order to appeal to a wider audience. I mean, the template is pretty simple. It had a charming actor playing a charismatic hero, like, say, a Robert Downey Jr. or a Chris Pratt. It didn't get too deep emotionally or philosophically, like a Thor or an Ant-Man movie. It didn't deconstruct the motivations of the hero or challenge the viewer to think much about the intricacies of the plot, like the Avengers or Guardians of the Galaxy. It interjected obvious and sometimes cliche humor, like pretty much all of them, and it had a shitty main villain, like every Iron Man movie. It doesn't surprise me a bit that this movie has done so well with the critics and with audiences. But you see, there's a reason why Winter Soldier is my favorite Marvel film. It's the most serious, it's the most grounded in humanity, it poses a deep philosophical question, it's unique. I can enjoy the action and still have my brain work. That's why I was thinking about Winter Soldier for days after I first saw it. Now that's not to say I don't like brain dump movies. The shallow end of the proverbial pool can be and is a lot of fun, which is why the first Guardians of the Galaxy is also one of my favorites. But I don't need all my superhero movies to be that way. Look, this is the negative part, but I want you to understand. I like Marvel's films. I just wish people would hold the same standards of criticism to them as they do to DC. See, Marvel gets pretty cookie-cutter sometimes. For example, a guy with a technologically advanced suit learns how to use it and ends up fighting a corporate executive using a more weaponized version of the same suit. Am I talking about Iron Man or Ant-Man? Another example. Hop on YouTube and search for the honest trailer to Guardians of the Galaxy. They make the point much more effectively than I could that Guardians of the Galaxy is basically Avengers in space. That's why, even though I thoroughly understand the need to follow the template and make it as palatable for the masses as possible, I'm going to worry that DC's movies will just become standard superhero fare. This movie commits a very familiar sin, committed by countless others. It didn't take away from the enjoyment of the movie for me, but I did become conscious of it. Diana enters, for lack of a better term, our world, and routinely encounters situations where women are treated as second-class citizens. Common sense would dictate that at some point prior on the long boat ride to London, that Steve would have told Diana what to expect when she gets there, what kind of society she's about to encounter. She could still confront the misogyny and the idiocy the same way she did, but she should not have been surprised by it because she should have already been told. But if you don't have Diana coming from a place of total ignorance, it's not as funny. A lot of movies do that, sacrificing common sense for running gags or for plot convenience. For example, I recently rewatched Doctor Strange on Netflix. You'd think somebody, anybody, would have tried to give some kind of explanation to Mordo as to why the Ancient One drew power from the Dark Dimension. But if they did that, then the writers would have to work harder to maneuver him into the role of the villain for the sequel. So there's that. Ares, the big bad guy, was a fumble. He's a good comic book villain, but he was mishandled on the big screen. Ares is the god of fucking war. Once he reveals himself, he no longer needs to be an aging mustache Brit under the helmet. He can be the red eyes piercing out of the shadows under his helmet like he is in the comics. And for the love of God, change his voice to something more powerful and commanding faster, so your big bad guy comes off as much more menacing. I mean, at the end, it just felt like Diana beat up on a little old man wearing some armor. Samir's comment about being both frightened and aroused is one of those examples of obvious and cliched lines of dialogue. But that's to be expected from a movie studio that's trying to lighten up the tone of its product. Those are the negative things I have to say about it. It may seem like a lot, but it really isn't. I liked the movie. I really liked the movie. In fact, as of this recording, I am just about, 4 hours away from having seen it again in the theaters. I think they captured the best of the title character and the best of the supporting cast as well. Here's what's great about the movie. I know they had to spend some time at the beginning of the movie on the island to set things up. Hippolyta's hesitance to allow Diana to leave is a pretty important part of the character's backstory, but I enjoyed that part of the movie. The location was amazing. Gina and I would go to Italy just to see that beach. And whoever did the CGI for the depiction of Themyscira should be applauded. It was gorgeous. The Amazons were fantastic in their fight scenes. You really got that sense that they were a powerful warrior race. And I think showing her roots enhances Diana's character so you appreciate that she's not only an excellent fighter, she's still a relative novice compared to the rest of her people. The little girl who played young Diana killed it. I believed this was a character who, even as a child, was bound and determined to be a fierce fighter. And it shows in that she's willing to defy her overprotective mother and learn in secret. And it's even cooler that when Hippolyta does find out, she concedes to the training only if they treat her daughter more stringently than anyone else they've ever trained. Now, Ares may have been a lousy villain, and Ludendorff, he was pretty generic. But Maru, the chemist with the creepy mask to cover her scars, she definitely needed more screen time. It was Diana finally understanding, reaching into that love she has for humanity and sparing Maru's life that turns the tide and brings her victory over Ares. I think that was also very important and something that I loved about the character. They tapped into that love that Diana has for humanity. Although it is highly unlikely we will ever see Maru's character again in the current DCEU continuity, some have already speculated that her concoction that gave Ludendorff temporary super strength could be the precursor to the Venom Serum that will eventually give super strength to Bane, one of Batman's villains. I like that the sword is not the God Killer, but it is actually Diana herself. Even though it was pretty obvious to me that Ludendorff wasn't Ares, when Sir Patrick is revealed and Diana's sword crumbles against his palm, that was a nice twist. I loved Lucy Davis as Etta Candy, a little-known but long-time Wonder Woman cast member. I know the actress as Liz's friend Diane from Shaun of the Dead, so I was happy to see her in the role. She doesn't have much to do in the movie, but she brings even more charm to the cast. For that matter, the Chief, Samir, and Charlie all had their charm, and it really is too bad that none of those characters are likely to come back in the current movie continuity. The World War I setting was ideal because it really pushed the misogyny of the time. Gal Gadot played the fish-out-of-water role perfectly. And that ice cream bit before they board the train to the war front is a take on a scene from her first appearance in the rebooted Justice League comic in the New 52. So that was a nice touch. And Gal Gadot should have finally silenced the last of the lazy fanboy critics who didn't think that she could pull off the role. She was powerful, regal, and compassionate from start to finish. Over the years, there have been speculation on actresses who could or should play Wonder Woman. Now that I've seen this movie, along with her introduction in Batman vs. Superman, I can't remember the names of any of those actresses, and I can't picture anybody else in the role. She is Wonder Woman. When Diana and Steve were on the boat going through the whole bit about sleeping together, my wife said under her breath, "About Diana, I'll sleep with you." Gal Gadot is her new girl crush, and she found Diana even more desirous than I did. And since my wife is adamantly heterosexual, that's saying something. Okay, movie review is over. And this is still a politically driven podcast, so the rest of this time is going to be about political issues kind of in the periphery of this movie. I don't understand why it took so long to get a female superhero movie made. I know, it's probably just me, but I don't understand the dismissiveness so many people have to a female-driven movie. For instance, last year's Ghostbusters. That remake, reboot, whatever you want to call it, was a good film. It was witty, silly, and respectful to the original. The upcoming Ocean's 8 has a great cast. I'm going to give it a look. And just like comic book movies, I'm going to view an Ocean's 8 or a female-led Ghostbusters as their own separate universe. Because let's be honest, folks, reboots are going to happen. Hollywood is running out of, Hollywood is running out of ideas. At least ideas that are good and will make them money. If a different take on an old story is good, that's what's important. So, whatever hang-ups all of you people out there have with female superhero movies or female-driven movies in general, please, get the fuck over it. Now, if you only care about skin color and gender, you could say that I am represented in comic books because I am a white male. If that's what you care about. I know there are some out there who believe I shouldn't even be allowed in the following discussion because I don't have the correct pigmentation or reproductive organs. Granted, I do get some cred for being a bisexual non-monogamist, but that only goes so far. By the way, the only white male bisexual non-monogamist that I can think of in the comic books is Catman from DC's Secret Six. And the bisexual part of that was only a recent change in the New 52. That character is more anti-hero, plus he and his team are currently not in publication. So, maybe you think I'm represented in comic books and have no right to say anything, or maybe you think I do have a right to voice my opinion. Regardless, I don't understand why the skin color or gender of a hero matters. I saw a tweet from a woman who wrote, and I'm paraphrasing here, "Now I understand why white guys like superheroes. After watching Wonder Woman, I wanted to go out and punch some bad guys." It has been a big deal for several years now for comic book companies to try to diversify their characters. I've watched audience members confront writers and artists at conventions, and they're not always polite about it. Why aren't you creating characters that look like me? Why aren't you creating characters that live a lifestyle like mine? When you do that, you're basically telling the comic book companies that you want the story to be about race or sexual orientation, not about a hero. The exact opposite of what enlightened people are trying to achieve. If you need a fictional character to have the same genitalia or skin color or live the same lifestyle as you before you can draw inspiration, then you have no idea what it means to be a hero. The hero part comes from the heart, the mind, the soul. It has nothing to do with your skin color or who you sleep with. If you witness a heroic act or read a heroic story and you dismiss it because the hero doesn't have your ethnicity or gender, then you need to take a look inside yourself to figure out why discrimination controls your judgment. I'm glad the producers, director, and actors in the movie didn't try to hit people over the head with their message. Yes, rampant misogyny exists. Yes, the hero stood up and shattered the idiotic prejudices, and it was awesome. But at no point did I feel like anyone behind the scenes was wagging their finger at the audience with their social and political message. Unfortunately, the same can't be said for other DC superheroes in the entertainment media in recent months. Sometimes, the people who run the shows want their ideology front and center. I'm talking about Supergirl. They have taken every opportunity to shoehorn anti-Trump, pro-immigration messages into their show. Now, before anybody misinterprets that last sentence, I'm on record in previous podcasts that our current president is awful, and this nation's immigration system is a disgusting pile of bureaucratic shit. But do you really need to force the dialogue of your TV show to include blatant political potshots? Ah, trick question. Of course, they can force their dialogue to include political potshots, and their episode titles too, for that matter. Freedom of speech means they get to speak their minds. But I bring this up because there is a great irony. The main antagonists at the end of the most recent season of Supergirl are the Daxamites. They are a race of people from the same solar system as Krypton who lost their home when Krypton was destroyed. Supergirl's love interest is Mon-El, the prince of the royal family. But Mon-El's mother is a tyrant, and she believes the Earth needs to be run by her family and populated by her people. So what is the solution for the heroes of the show? They set off a bomb that pollutes the Earth's atmosphere with just enough lead to make the planet uninhabitable to Daxamites. In the show, like in the comics, lead is poison to them. Of course, this means that the love interest has to leave the planet and can never return. Any Daxamites who may have been persuaded to break away from their tyrant queen have to leave the planet and never return. Yes, the same people who beat their viewers over the head with anti-Trump and pro-immigration messages for half the season create a wall around the planet in order to keep unwanted aliens out and tacitly support the very policy they spent so much time mocking. In contrast, when they took on the gun rights issue in Arrow, they gave a respectful voice to both sides and acknowledged that both sides have valid points. For somebody like myself, who believes you have the right to defend yourself from any perceived threat, I'll remember that they treated my point of view with respect. I do believe in the adage that just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something. When you have an outlet as powerful as a television show or a movie that will be seen by anywhere from tens of thousands to millions of people, you can do with it what you will. You can make a very blatant, one-sided, terse argument for what you believe. You can be as petty and hypocritical as you want with your message. That's fine, because once again, this is America, and you have the right to express your opinion, even if you are in the elite position to have a media outlet that scant few others have. Or you can realize that other people have had other life experiences, and they may actually dare to think or believe something other than your narrow vision. And if you do realize that, you may instead choose to present your point of view in a way that will hope to bring people together in respect and understanding, rather than trying to alienate and divide. Supergirl absolutely failed to do so. Arrow absolutely succeeded. I've already told you what I felt about the Wonder Woman movie itself. But in the underlying political and social issues, I'm glad they, like the character they put on display, chose the nobler path. I already had respect for the character, and given the proverbial mountains they had to climb to make the movie, I also had respect for the actors and director for their efforts. I have even more respect now that they showed respect for all of their patrons, not just the ones who had matching reproductive organs. That was a very Wonder Woman-y thing to do. This is the Raging Rhino Podcast. You'll hear from me again.